Measure Up Podcast, Episode 35, Soft Skills for KPI Success. G'day and welcome. I'm Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist of StaceyBarr.com and your host for the Measure Up podcast. I believe performance measurement is the foundation for an organisation to be truly excellent at what it exists to do, and my passion is to make it easy and fun for you to do performance measurement meaningfully and engagingly. When I first started to shape my career as a performance measure specialist, there were several turning points that ultimately had a profound impact, actually, not only on my approach to facilitating performance measurement teams, but also on how I've developed the PUMP methodology itself. One of those turning points was a group facilitations course that I took in the mid-1990s. I learned how to be more observant of the body language and interactions of people in a group. I learned how to be aware that people have, I guess, kind of an inner world that influences how they might contribute on any particular day. I learned how people's weaknesses are a necessary consequence of their strengths. And I learned some practical techniques for how to do things like increase participation, balance the contributions coming from different members in the group, to maintain focus of the group on the goals, to rein in discussions that fly off at tangents, to disarm conflict, and even to heighten the ownership that the group takes for its outcomes. I reckon that it really doesn't matter how eloquent your technical approach might be. Without having a really good appreciation for how to work with people in groups and how to anticipate and facilitate those inevitable challenges that come with this, you just can't get the outcomes that you want, or the outcomes the group wants, really. Before I took the group facilitation skills course, I thought that good measurement practice was enough to convince people of a better way. And I remember on one occasion, I took one of the organization's safety KPIs and turned it into an XMR chart. Now, that's the type of chart that highlights true signals in performance measures of change over time, like an increase in performance or a decrease. I brought my new safety KPI chart to a safety meeting to show the safety manager and his committee that this KPI really hadn't improved at all over the previous 2 years. I expected them to say, how insightful is this? But instead, the safety manager literally howled at me in front of everyone. He said I had no idea what I was doing and that the new chart I was showing them was completely wrong. That stung. And while I was crying in the ladies' room afterwards, from the shock and embarrassment of being publicly hauled over the coals, I started to realise what I'd actually done. I had challenged the safety manager's reputation and his status by showing a graph that, at least to him, was saying that he'd failed to improve performance. Now, these days I'd take a completely different approach because I understand more about how measurement affects people and also how people affect measurement. Firstly, I probably would have talked with the safety manager about his goals for safety performance, about what he saw as the priorities to stay focused on and what he felt were the main constraints holding performance back from the targets that he wanted to reach. Then I might have asked him to show me how he was currently measuring safety performance, how he was currently graphing those measures, and what those graphs were telling him. Now, if I saw that he might have been misinterpreting the data, I'd have likely stepped him through how an XMR chart works, maybe with an example, and then I would have offered to help him try them out on the safety KPIs of his choice. So rather than just blurting out something like, "See, performance hasn't improved for more than 2 years," I'd instead have asked him what initiatives were currently underway to improve performance and what obstacles they might be facing and how we might use the safety KPIs along with other data to help stakeholders better understand what to do to overcome the obstacles. In other words, I would now take a much more collaborative approach than I originally did, and I would see my role as different also. I'd see my role as making the safety manager feel and appear to others too to be even in more control of safety performance. Now, the facilitation skills course that I took taught me much about how to approach sensitive topics like performance measurement with groups who are, you know, either new to the topic or have had bad experiences in the past or who are a bit defensive maybe about performance for whatever reason. And in this podcast, I want to share with you my teacher. His name is Dr. Michael Sheehan, and I recently interviewed him about using soft skills to facilitate groups just like measures teams.
Well, g'day, this is Stacey Barr here, Performance Measure Specialist of StaceyBarr.com and creator of the Performance Measurement Methodology, PUMP. Today, I'm talking with Michael Sheehan, who is the Managing Director of Workplace Behaviours for Sustainable Organisations and is based here in Southeast Queensland, Australia. Michael's actually an old friend and colleague of mine and someone whose work has had a profoundly important impact on the work that I do today in performance measurement. When I was working in Queensland Rail back in the 90s as the measurement consultant, my very progressive manager at that time really appreciated how important it was to have the soft skills to complement the more technical skills that we typically associate with performance measurement. You know, the technical skills like designing meaningful performance measures, working with numbers and statistics, creating useful and usable performance reports, and interpreting trends and signals in performance. They are very important. But without the soft skills, those skills of working with people, you won't get the fundamental understanding and buy-in that brings the whole idea of performance measurement to life. Now, my first experience of learning these soft skills was with Michael Sheehan. He took me and my colleagues at Queensland Rail through a group facilitation skills training course, and I learned a ton of powerful stuff, things like how to read the dynamic in a group, how to facilitate people to work together and stay focused on the task at hand, how to prevent conflict, how to disarm it when conflict does arise, how to nurture a group to take ownership of what they're doing and of what they're producing. And I want to share Michael with you so that you can get a taste of just how powerful these soft skills really are. Now, Michael, before we do that, I'm hoping you wouldn't mind sharing just a bit of your background and what you're up to these days.
Thanks, Stacey. Well, as you said, I'm Managing Director of an organisation called Workplace Behaviours for Sustainable Organisations. I am based in the Redlands, which is a shire just south of Brisbane. I have had a 20-year career as an academic, both here and in the UK. Came back almost 2 years ago for family reasons, and I've my business, I do research, I do writing, I continue to attempt to publish within academic journals, and I would like to continue with some of the work that you have just spoken about as you introduced me there in terms of soft skill development with people in organisations, whether that be small, large, public or private sector.
Tremendous. I think a really good place to start then, Michael, is for us to talk about a little about what group dynamics is, what group facilitation is, and how those softer skills are different to what most people would be familiar with, which is chairing a meeting.
Yep. Okay. Well, if I just start off with what I think is process facilitation, the way I see it, process facilitation is a group social process that ought to make achievement of an outcome less difficult or easier or more convenient and ought to promote action. So it's about movement. It's about successful facilitators needing, first of all, to self-facilitate and then to facilitate groups effectively. For me, the focus is on process rather than content, and maybe I should briefly explain what I mean there. Content is the task that people generally focused on. So, for example, when you mentioned performance measures there, it might be the statistics or the analytical side. The process is what people are doing or how they're going about completing that task. And it's often in the process things that groups break down, that dynamics emerge that are less than helpful to the achievement of group and individual goals. So process facilitation helps make things easier or encourage movement, helps develop shared meaning between group members, which I think is really important. The overall objective ought to be for the facilitator to help the group achieve what it wants to achieve rather than what the facilitator wants to achieve. And I think in that sense it's different from chairing a meeting. If perhaps I can go on and you ask me about group dynamics and how is it different to chairing a meeting, if I can just very briefly explain there, process facilitation is about being attuned to those actions and activities of people working in groups. So a facilitator needs to be aware of the dynamics that occur in groups and the processes that groups go through at various stages. Now, lots and lots of researchers have defined those stages, and possibly the most well-known one is the model by Tuckman and Jensen, which is a five-stage process that I won't go into in depth here, other than to say that a facilitator needs to be aware of those processes. So what Tuckman labelled forming, storming, norming, performing and adjourning. Because in each of those processes, different things tend to happen in terms of group dynamics. For example, at the forming stage, when a group's first getting together, people can be a little shy, they can be unsure of who they're working with, or what the purpose of the activity is, or what goals they are being asked to achieve. There'll be issues such as identity, for example, who am I and what's my role in this group, and acquaintanceship issues such as, well, who are these other people and what do I know about them and how do I get to know them a little better within a short time frame. So all those sorts of dynamics then alter as the group works through, issues of role, issues of leadership, conflict tends to emerge and needs to be addressed, and a facilitator is someone who needs to be very attuned to what's happening in a group such that if they can quickly recognise conflict and attempt to deal with it, for me, as soon as it happens, some wait for the conflict to move on a little. I often find that can be quite disruptive and unhelpful to people. So it's about helping groups work through the stages that groups inevitably go through when they're put together to achieve a task or a goal or a number of goals, and it's then helping them to negotiate people's roles within those stages of the group, to address any relationship issues or leadership issues that tend to emerge, and to account for and bring to the attention of people the dynamics that are occurring. So a facilitator, and indeed I try to encourage people learning the skills if they're then working in a group, not necessarily as a facilitator, but just as a member of the group, to indeed utilise some of those skills to self-facilitate and facilitate the group. So a facilitator needs to be a keen observer of human behaviour. He or she needs to be able to intervene in the process and to make suggestions for change, and then to help the group evaluate what has happened. I think those steps are vitally important.
I was going to just relay some of my own experiences, linking back to some of the things that you'd said about those stages that a group goes through when it forms and all the way through its life cycle to when it adjourns. One of the things that I've found very useful in getting a new group of people together, which I call a measures team, who are tasked with the content of developing performance measures for their department or for their business unit. Getting them together at that very first meeting is often quite apprehensive for a lot of people because they've got all of these negative ideas and a lot of that baggage about what performance measurement's about from the past, and they usually are feeling not particularly excited or warmed up to the idea. One of the things that I find is a great way to get everyone started is to help them find some common ground to understand what they're sharing. And we do that by exploring what has gone wrong with measurement in the past. So we actually address that baggage that they're bringing into the room and have a conversation about it and use that as a way of leveraging forward. So that's part of the maybe that's part of the forming stage where they're understanding that they actually do have some shared goals. There's a ton of things that you've just said that have impacted the way that I've facilitated groups. Now, one thing that I've attempted to do, and I think I haven't done too badly over the years, is to be both the leader of the group on a content level, in other words, facilitating or leading them through the tasks associated with the performance measurement work that we're doing, at the same time as being the group dynamics facilitator or the process facilitator, where I'm observing their body language, who's looking like they don't want to be there, who's looking like they're trying to say something but isn't getting an opportunity to, who's just pulled an interesting face with something that somebody else said and what could that mean, and is there any kind of, body language that suggests there's some tension between members in the group? And I'm scanning for those sorts of things and trying to deal with them as they come up. But managing process and managing content, I remember you saying to us, Michael, is not very easy to do. So I would like to explore with you more about this leadership role, perhaps in the performance measurement context. Who should take that leadership role, and can they really monitor both the content and the process, or is that better split between a couple of people?
Well, I think there's probably a number of ways, Stacey. If you think about the stages that the groups are going through, then at that initial stage, perhaps someone needs to be there, in such as yourself, in a role that says, I'm going to help you with both content and process. But as the groups, and this will always, I guess, depend on how long those groups are going to be working together, what particular tasks they have to complete, it might be that someone, and it can be a shared role, officially a shared role, that two or three people might take responsibility for observing process. That will also clearly depend on the size of the group. If you're only working with three or four people, you're highly unlikely to want three or four who fall into the official facilitator role. If you've got 30 or 40, then you probably need three or four to keep an eye on that. But my own preference is to provide people with the skills that enables them to be a facilitator, such that leadership becomes a shared role. That even though, for example, yourself might be there as the appointed expert and therefore generally is seen to have that leadership role, if I'm helping people learn these skills, then my intention is to encourage everybody in the group to take on that leadership role, to make observations when they do notice some of those things you mentioned, that someone agrees with something or seems to agree with something, but at the same time they're nodding their head in a no fashion or seem to be shifting uncomfortably in their seat, or they walk out of the room as they say it, or they give a nervous laugh or whatever it might be, or they become argumentative or seem to disagree with people on many occasions, can't see the positive in what people are suggesting and so on. So for me, it's about encouraging people to share that role. And that then does become difficult, as you suggest, because people are focusing on content because they have a task to achieve, and their manager has possibly said, well, I would like you to achieve these goals within a certain time frame. And that time frame will be driving their thinking. And at the same time, they've got to be managing that process. I think it's a task that everybody can learn to do, and through sharing that leadership, I find the groups then tend to share meaning about what it is that's happening within the group, not only in the completion of task, but in the completion of process, and that in turn becomes a learning process about self, so they come to a greater awareness of themselves and a greater awareness, of course, of group dynamics that will stand them in good stead no matter where they might work or indeed in their broader lives, like if they're just with a group of friends or if they belong to a sports club or a book club or a car club or whatever it might be. They then can, I think, become better connected and more deeply connected through a mutual commonality or relationship that they're able to form with those people, because they are able to share deeper things about themselves without, of course, driving people nuts by sharing, you know, all their terrible things that happen in their lives. Like, you know, you say to someone, how are you? And they tell you their last 25 medical procedures. You don't really want to know that. It's an icebreaker, if you like, which in a sense is what you started to ask me about then, what you do in terms of those icebreakers. But if people come with all these negative perceptions about what it is they're being asked to do and how they might go about that, then it is useful. I think it's a brilliant strategy to actually get them to talk about those things at the start and in a sense, get that out of their system. So you can start those sorts of things just by asking simple questions like, what is it you don't like about performance measurement? Or what are the terrible things that you've heard? But then you can equally turn it around to the positive about what are the good things that you've heard? What are the positive things that you find of using various performance measurement tools and strategies, and turn that around? My focus at all times is to get people more attuned to process rather than content at the start. People will always walk into a room if they've got a task that they've been asked to complete. They'll sit down in the group and they'll get straight into achieving that task. And that's when things start to fall down, because they're not aware of process. Someone will, you know, be the dominant speaker, or someone will talk over the top of others, or someone will jump up to the whiteboard and want to scribble furiously all their ideas and thoughts without perhaps even having met the other people in the group. So for me, it's always important that the process things are dealt with initially, and then that those things need to be raised. And for me, the best way to do that is to provide people with the skills that help them to do that, perhaps unobtrusively, once they've got to a level where they can do so. In a new group, it's possibly more useful to have someone who has facilitation skills to come in and help the group in the first instance. And my intention is always to develop a group to a stage where I can walk away knowing that they don't need me anymore. I don't want to be coming back into an organisation forever, because I want people to learn the skills such that they can do it themselves.
Absolutely. And that's certainly the experience I've had. I mean, when it was back in the mid-90s, I think I learned this stuff from you, and it's still with me. You know, it's still influencing what I do, like you said, not just in a work setting, but in every aspect of life. You know, sometimes people will say to me, you're just so easy to talk to. You listen really well. And I think, well, thanks, Michael Sheehan. No, honestly, because you do take those skills just everywhere. You have that higher level of self-awareness and a higher level of other awareness, and you do start naturally looking at the dynamics, what's going on in a group setting, and your responses to some of those things start becoming almost automatic. But, Michael, I'd like to take us back to something that you've started talking about here, which is when you set up a new team, a team that has just formed, and we'll say that they are a measures team, a team that's about to start a performance measurement process. What are some of the things that you would do to set that team up from the start? And you alluded to it being about focusing first on process rather than content. So we wouldn't get the team together and have the first question be, so what do you think we should measure? Instead, we ought to be starting that group off in a different way. So what are some of the strategies or the ways that you would help to form a new team, set them up?
Yeah, can I assume here that people don't know each other, or is it indeed that they do work together closely?
They do work together closely. So they, let's say that they do know each other, and it might be one or two people may not know each other particularly well, but that at least if they know each other's names, they would have met at least once before.
Okay. I'd nonetheless still get them to introduce themselves, and I'd get them to share just a little bit about themselves. Because even though people work together for many years, often they don't know just little insights into people. And you can do that through simple, I think, sentences that might start off with, why don't each person introduce yourself and say what it is that you like most about yourself. So, try and start it off positively. People will always talk about the negative things, tell us something about yourself and they'll say, oh, well, I'm always late for meetings, or I don't particularly like working in small groups, or whatever it might be. But if you can get them to start with something positive, I think that's useful. So those sorts of simple icebreakers, and then to seek some clarification of their understanding of why they're actually there. Because sometimes people come along to these groups, they may have been sent in at the last moment because someone else has withdrawn or hasn't reported for work that day, and so the manager says, well, you better go along and be part of this because they've got people from the other three sections and we need to have a representative so we don't miss out.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very unsure and very uncertain. People are also apprehensive, even though they might know those other people. When they come together in a small group setting to work on a particular task, they can be quite apprehensive about some of the things I mentioned before, like what is my role? What am I required to do? How am I going to get on with these other people? Oh, I have to work with so-and-so, and we're always arguing in the normal workplace. I don't really want to be here. So those sorts of things, I think, need to be explored at the start, and you can do that through people just in the introductory phase, or if they don't particularly want to share that, if you think they've you've perhaps already discovered this through discussions with your client, that they might be very apprehensive about getting together, you can do it anonymously. For example, they might write a note on their idea or their thoughts or whatever on a post-it note that you then put up on a whiteboard or on the wall or something where everybody can see what it is, but no one knows who's written it. Or you can get them to write something on a piece of paper and throw it in on the floor in the middle of the group and then ask others to pick it up and read it out. And more than likely, you'll find that there'll be some commonalities as to what people are afraid of or uncertain about or what apprehensions they might bring. And then you deal with those. So raise them as issues. And if someone says, well, I'm really apprehensive about being here because I don't know what I'm required to do, then a question for me is, well, what would help make things clearer for you at this stage? And encourage people to talk and share those things at that point.
I remember, Michael, you were talking to us about ground rules, about how a team should... Yes. Make an agreement about how it wants to work together?
I think things like ground rules and guidelines, all guidelines, are very important. I sometimes hesitate with using the word ground rules because people then tend to become rule-bound, and if someone breaches or is seen to breach one of those rules, other people can get quite aggressive about that. For example, if a ground rule is we will... return to a session on time, so if they have a break, we'll come back on time, and someone's a minute late, then, for whatever reason, then others might get very upset. Or guidelines are often put up in such esoteric terms, it's hard to understand what it is that's meant. Like, we'll have openness and we'll have honesty. Those words mean very different things to people in groups. And it takes some time, I think, to establish working relationships or indeed personal relationships where we can come to a deeper appreciation of what it is we mean by those sorts of terms. I mean, how can you tell when someone is not being honest, for example, or how can you tell when someone is not being open? They will only share as much as they feel comfortable sharing. So I've more lately in my career, I guess, of doing this sort of work, and as you say, it does go back quite a while, I tend to use words like guidelines. But again, if a group says, oh, we're happy with ground rules, then I'll go with ground rules. But it is about setting boundaries or setting parameters about behaviours. I do remember working with one group where it was a group of all male. They were in heavy engineering, a blue-collar workforce, and one of their guidelines was there'll be no physical violence. And I thought, boy, what have I walked into here? In a sense, it was said with some humour, but in talking to those guys, it was also because at that stage that sort of thing was happening in their workplace. Now, you know, hopefully workplaces have advanced a little, although we still do hear of violence occurring in organisations. I mean, you know, a paramedic or a police officer or indeed a nurse in a hospital probably some violence almost on a daily basis, depending on the type of work they do in those sorts of roles. So, yeah, I do think ground rules or guidelines are important. And then it's about becoming clear on goals or the establishment of goals and working through all those sorts of things and focusing on, well, how are we going to go about doing that, to process things before actually beginning the task. So for me, content and process, which tend to be buzzwords, are important to explain, but then there's another, an even buzzier word, if you like, and that's meta-process, getting groups to actually take the time to process their process. And that requires a level of reflection as an individual and as a group about what things have we done well here, what are we continuing with, what do we want to continue doing, and where are things perhaps falling down, and what do we need to do differently? And again, that does take a level of trust. It does take a level of individual and group maturity to bring those sorts of things out. And indeed, it's possibly a stage when some conflict can begin to arise because someone will say, well, I don't like it when you blah, blah, blah. Or it annoys me when you talk over the top of everybody. Or, you know, I had an impression that you were going to be easy to work with, and what I'm finding is that it's quite difficult to work with you. And then a facilitator really needs to step in, I think, and deal with those sorts of issues. And if you have a ground rule about openness or honesty, then you have to acknowledge, indeed, if people are saying that, clearly they are being open and honest. But, of course, the person on the receiving end will feel like they're, or may feel like they're being attacked or being humiliated or whatever, and that needs then to be dealt with. And those issues can initially get in the road of what a group is trying to achieve, but once they have been dealt with, chances are that the group will achieve at a much better level than they might otherwise have done. The thing with conflict, there's no really, for me anyway, no really easy answers. I just like to deal with it as soon as I become aware that it's happening, and that might be through watching the non-verbals or indeed the verbals, or it might be someone who says something to me in a break that indicates they're not happy with what's happening in the group, but they're unsure or unwilling to raise it. I think all those things are important, and if you've got those ground rules or guidelines or boundaries or whatever, then you can return to those and say, look, you know, we did agree at the start that we would have openness. Now, there's an issue that's arising. It seems to be causing some difficulty. What are we going to do to address that issue? And sometimes just making the process observation is enough for people to become aware of things and to say, oh, okay, look, I really wasn't aware that was happening. Thanks for bringing that to my attention, and I'll be right from here on in. And sometimes they are.
Yeah, that reminds me of, I know that we're not going to be able to go into the detail of any of these things, but one of the tools that you taught us, I think, was called the escalating intervention model, which is I guess it's a type of meta process as well that a facilitator uses as a strategy for how they go about managing a conflict or an issue that's arising in a group. And when you said just then, sometimes just making the process observation is enough, and I think that might be step one or step two of the model, where you just say, look, you guys, are you happy with how productive we're being, or are you happy with the level of conversation we're having, or are you happy with the amount of participation everybody is engaging in? And sometimes that can be enough just to put everyone else's attention onto that and solve it.
Absolutely. But there are,
sorry, Michael, did you want to add some more to that?
Well, there is a seven-step model I do use. I won't go into it, as you rightly suggest. And that first step is inform. So just give the group some information about what it is that you're observing. The second step, and that just alerts them to what's happening. And they might ignore you. They might decide to do something about it or somewhere in between. The next step then is inform and invite. So you give them that information and you invite them to do something differently or to do something about addressing that particular situation. And again, it can range from, we'll deal with that right now, to just ignoring you it's like you're talking over the top of them and they're so focused on task, they want to continue. The third step is a minor intervention, so I would suggest something. And that can simply be, look, it does appear that you run into some roadblocks. Why don't you're unable to make a decision? Why don't we just take a 5-minute break? And sometimes that can just be enough to re-energise the group. If I skip through, the seventh step is give up and go home. And fortunately, I've never got to that stage. And I hope I never do. But because I think if other things have been done appropriately in the first instance, then you don't necessarily get to stage seven.
Well... So there's a bunch of typical things that can happen, Michael, in a measures team, in a team that's together to develop performance measures and get them implemented. And what I'd love to do is go through some of them now, and maybe you could share a few tips with how you might handle that kind of issue as a facilitator of that group. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
So the first one I've got here, the first challenge that can come up in a measures team is when there's a particular person in the measures team that just isn't participating. Maybe they're sitting there with their arms folded. Maybe they're looking around the room. Maybe they're looking like they're listening intently, but they're just not saying anything. They're not contributing ideas. What would you do if that came up?
I think there's a number of steps. One of the things I would do is raise the issue in hopefully what is a non-threatening way. And I say hopefully because no matter which way you do this, it can have an impact that you might not expect on the individual. And for me, that's always the challenge of working with groups of people. So you might say, look, I noticed that we've had some discussion going on now for some time, and Mary, you're sitting there with your arms folded and you haven't said anything. I'm just wondering if what we've been talking about is of interest to you or something like that. Mm. So make an observation. You can also make an interpretation and indeed check for understanding. So, you know, you're sitting there with your arms folded. You've not had any input to what the group's been talking about. My interpretation is that, and, you know, it can be a range of things from you're not interested to you're confused or you're unsure. Can I just clarify with you that that's what's happening for you? And at that stage, they may react in goodness knows what sort of way. Basically from, yes, I'm finding it difficult to have my say, or I don't really want to be here, or how dare you correct me in front of the group. I feel humiliated by what it is that you've just said to me. And you need them to deal with that. I certainly try to encourage quieter members to speak up, but again, one of the ways to do that is simply run around the group if you've got 4 or 5 or 25 people in a group and get everybody to have a contribution in turn. And that way they get to hear their voice within the group. Later you will observe those who are more outspoken than others, and that's when you need to perhaps deal with it more in terms of observation, interpretation, intervention, and so on.
Yeah.
If it's a large group, you can use subgroups. So if someone isn't participating, break the big group down into smaller groups. Certainly encouraging active listening, which is one of the things you mentioned before about developing your listening skills. Attempt to address the needs of that individual, because people have individual and social needs in those groups. By that I mean that they do want to achieve, but that wanting to achieve often provokes competitiveness with colleagues. They do want to understand what's happening. So, and that often encourages, I think, curiosity and learning and creativity and innovation. They also want to protect, and they want to be protected, and that can be from what they perceive as attacks upon them by other members of the group, including the appointed facilitator. And they want to connect. They do want to be cared for by their colleagues, and in turn, generally, they want to care for their colleagues, and they want to ensure that teamwork happens. I mean, people generally have good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have intentions. And I try to work with that positive mindset in my head, that what they're wanting to do is for the best or for the better, and they're not necessarily being obtuse or unwilling or whatever.
That just rings bells for me, that idea of starting with the intention that people do want to do good things. They want to contribute positively. I very often get warnings from my clients before we start our very first measures team meeting, and my client will say, oh, look, just be careful with Bob. We always have trouble with Bob, or Sue is always trying to dominate, or they'll give me warnings about people that I'll have to be extra careful with that are going to cause major problems. But I find that if I go into a group and let go of those impressions that people have shared with me and have that belief that everyone is wanting to do the best they can, I have to say I have never, well, no, once, okay, once out of hundreds of situations, Bob or Sue or whoever it is has never been a problem. I've never had an issue with them. They've contributed really well. And I think just going in with that intention sets a positive energy, and it gives everyone permission to be exactly who they are and to contribute the way they want to contribute.
Yeah, I think it's important to be open to everybody, because those stereotypes that a client or manager might pass on to you may in fact turn out to be incorrect in your situation. It might be that they are difficult with that manager and difficult in the workplace, but when they're working in a team with you, they're a completely different personality. And in my early days, I used to ask. I would say to my client, "Now, is there someone I should be wary of, or are there some issues that are likely to arise that you haven't told me about?" And I found that I'd go in with those things in my head, but it wasn't Bob or Sue that was the person who was less than helpful in the group. It was indeed someone else. All of a sudden, I think, well, what's going on here? And Bob and Sue would in fact finish up being the thought leaders, possibly because they raise the negatives. In De Bono's terms, they do the black hat thinking.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important role in a group as to why things won't work. It just becomes debilitating when people repeat it ad nauseum or only ever seem to pass on negative comments. And if those people are doing that, then we need to somehow turn them around into trying to think about things in a positive way. So, for example, I would say, well, look, what is it you would do to help this situation or to progress this idea, or what's something positive you can say about the idea? And encourage them into thinking about things in a different way.
Indeed. Another one of the challenges that comes up fairly frequently for people when they are facilitating a measurement project with a team is that the manager of the business unit or the department that they're developing measures for is a member of the measures team, so they're there in those meetings. But because the manager's there, a couple of things can happen. One is the manager can end up dominating the discussion, and sort of, I guess it's a double-edged double-edged sword, I suppose. I'm not sure if that's the right metaphor here. But at the same time, the other participants, feel wary of what they're going to say because they feel like they've got to submit to whatever the manager's idea is. Does that make sense, Michael?
Oh, it does, and that certainly accords with my experience. A manager can play a whole range of roles, either simply because he or she comes with that appointed role into the group, or indeed that's just the way they are. I think if a manager is dominating the discussion, then you've got to do, I think, some of the things that I'd mentioned before about making a process observation and interpretation. Perhaps you can go back and revisit your guidelines, and one of those guidelines might be that we share the time equally, mm-hmm. that everybody has a contribution, but no one predominant theory or ideology should dominate the discussion, that we listen actively. I guess you've got to suss out too how the group relates to that manager in the workplace. If it's a manager they simply distrust because of past experiences, then you possibly have to deal with that in a different way to a manager that they do trust and they do like and they are able to share their thoughts and feelings openly without thinking, oh, he or she's going to use this against me at some time in the future. So I think, time sharing, sometimes you've just got to take those people aside and have a quiet word with them and say, look, you know, while it's important that you are here and that you're making a contribution, my impression is that you're always the first one to respond to a question, or you tend to over-talk when someone is putting forward their ideas. That seems to be upsetting them. Are there other ways that you think you could behave in this group such that we achieve what it is that you've hired me to help you achieve?
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes you just got to... I prefer to do it in front of the group, because if we have a group guideline about being, or guidelines about openness and honesty and sharing, then it should be done in a group. But sometimes that doesn't work, and it's about having a quiet word with them.
Yeah.
Might be kissing your career goodbye in that particular organisation or your opportunity for further work, but that's an ethical consideration then. That's for any individual, of course, to make.
Absolutely. So just on exploring some of these slightly nastier little problems that can come up in groups, while we're on that, there's another one that that definitely happens too, and you don't always know it until it kind of sneaks right up on you and goes boo, and that's where there are hidden agendas, where people have come into the group with their own ideas or their own outcome, and they haven't made that open and apparent from the start. So how would you address that situation, Michael, where hidden agendas pop up?
Yeah, again, that's you're right, it does creep up on you and hit you, and it is a very difficult one to address. I certainly have come across it on any number of occasions in my experience, not only as a facilitator, but just in work generally. I think one of the things we do, and it goes back to one of the discussions we've just had a couple of moments ago, is we often make assumptions about others and their motives. And similarly, we set unrealistic or unattainable ground rules, such as honesty or openness or so on. And so there are things that it's rare that we can fulfil those sorts of objectives that we might have. So when those sorts of things happen, like the hidden agenda may become apparent, it might not become apparent. You hear about it as a side conversation in a corridor somewhere. But again, you simply have to raise it with that person. You seem to be concerned about this issue, or you're not having any input, or whatever your observation is. You're sitting there with your arms folded, or your heads drop down to your lap, or whatever it might be. Make an interpretation of what you've observed and stress that it is an interpretation, and check for some understanding about what it is that's bothering that particular person. So, their hidden agenda might be that they had come along to the group with an assumption that Bob and Sue were going to be difficult to work with, and indeed that had turned out to be the case, and they simply didn't want to work with them, and therefore they weren't going to have any input whenever Bob or Sue spoke. So it's about then, well, what are the assumptions that you're making about Bob and Sue and raising that? And that is when conflict will arise, and you've got to be prepared to deal with that. It might be that that person then decides to leave the group, and you've probably got to live with that. That's their choice. I always do, especially when I'm helping people learn these skills, make it apparent that if people feel that then they're going to be uncomfortable, or they are uncomfortable, and that they might want to leave and leave now, and nothing further is said. Of course, they always feel under pressure that their manager has sent them along to learn these skills.
Indeed.
And they feel obligated to stay. But having said that, I have had on occasions one or two people leave at that stage and say, yeah, I don't think this is for me, because they can see they're going to have to share a little bit about themselves, and they're just not prepared to do that. Others come with a completely open mind. Pardon me. They want to. They're there to learn new things, to learn about groups, to learn about teams, to learn about performance measurement, performance tools that they might use, and they are completely open to learning those new skills and to go away thinking, hey, this is great. I've learned not only something about statistics, but I've learned something about who I am as a person and how I communicate with others. So, hidden agendas are a particularly difficult one.
We've probably got time, Michael, for one more that we can explore, an issue that comes up in groups typically, in any group, but certainly in performance measurement groups, and then we might wrap up. And the last challenge I'd like to talk about is when the team goes off on tangents, when they start a conversation that doesn't seem to have any strong relationship to the task at hand, to the content that the group agreed to work on. So they might be designing a measure for a particular performance goal or performance result. They're following through the process for measure design, but then a conversation comes up where they start talking about improvement strategies that might help to achieve that performance result. So they're no longer talking about measures now, they're now talking about improvement solutions or initiatives or projects or ideas, and then that leads them off onto another tangent. How do you handle tangents? Because they waste time.
Yeah, well, they do. And I think it comes back to some of those things that we have been talking about, the hidden agendas and so on. It is about using that seven-step model. For me, it's a model developed by a Brisbane psychologist by the name of Bob Dick. I think it's a particularly useful model. As I said, I've never got to step seven, which is give up and go home. But it is about passing on information to the group in the first instance, by attempting to do that in a non-threatening way. So make an observation of what it is you're hearing and what you're seeing, interpreting that, and then checking for understanding, which again is about having active listening skills. If it continues to go on, then it's inform and invite. So ask them about doing something differently. And then a minor intervention there might be to suggest a change, such as if it's in a particularly big group, that they go and work in smaller groups, or that they begin to do some use a different data gathering tool. They might do some brainstorming, or you might go around the group to get each person's idea, so a round robin type process. So you can suggest a number of things. It might be, as I said earlier, just suggesting that they have a break for five or 10 minutes. Sometimes people begin to go off on tangents because they're becoming tired, and rather than stick on or stay on, stay focused on what they've been talking about, they then drift into those other things that all of a sudden turn into how their footy team went on the weekend or whatever. Or how do they? Yeah.
Exactly. It's funny. I often chuckle after some meetings at the kinds of little challenges that came up, and just the fact that they do come up, and you just think, where did that come from? How did that end up being something that the group chose to talk about, like the footy on the weekend or whatever. Okay, so everybody who is listening, I am very confident that you picked up several really practical tips for how you can work better with your measures teams, how you can be more aware of the fact that there's usually a couple of things going on in a group. One, the task that they're working on, which in everyone's case here is probably a performance measurement related task, but also the process, the way the group goes about doing that, and also how you can be very conscious of how the process might be breaking down or not working as well as it could, and therefore getting in the way of getting the task done. And Michael shared quite a few little practical strategies there, and many of them are based on that escalating intervention model that he mentioned. Michael, thank you so much for doing this interview with me and for sharing these tips with everybody. If people are curious to learn more, and they have to be, I mean, we've only scratched the surface here, and maybe are interested in getting you to come in and do a training workshop for them to teach their people about how to be aware of group process and how to manage it and what this seven-step escalating intervention model is and other tools that you have, what is the best way, Michael, for them to get in contact with you?
Probably two ways, Stacey, either via email or telephone. My email is michael.sheehan, that's S-H-E-E-H-A-N, @, and I'll give you the @ and then I'll explain. It's @ wb4so.com, that's W for William, B for Bob, for the figure 4, S for Sam, and O for Orange. Or they can contact me by telephone, which is +61 7 3134 0610.
Tremendous. You're going to explain the WB4SO.
Oh, sorry. I gave the call signals or whatever, didn't I? It's Workplace Behaviours for Sustainable Organisations.
Excellent, which is the name of the company that you, the organisation that you run, obviously.
That's it.
Michael, thanks again. This has been great. I mean, people just don't talk about this stuff, particularly in the performance measurement field. We talk about the challenges that we have in trying to get people engaged in measurement, but very rarely do we talk about the how-to to work more on that engagement. And what you've shared with us today is a really great start for understanding how we can increase that engagement. So thank you very much for being my guest today.
All right. Thank you, Stacey, and thank you for the opportunity.
Awesome.
Now, Michael's gentle but very matter-of-fact approach to this softer topic of group facilitation was so refreshing to me. I learned a heap from him because his authenticity and openness and humility just made it very easy to learn from him. For me, taking Michael's training course was actually a happy accident. It was certainly not something I would have sought out myself at that time. But because of the amazing impact that it's had on my success now in engaging people in a topic that, well, you know, it's so stereotypically dry and unsexy, at least it first appears to be that way to a lot of people, my wish for you is that you seek out to develop these softer skills intentionally. It really does make a world of difference. And remember, you can download these podcasts and also a ton of practical articles at measureupblog.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast at iTunes. Just search for Measure Up. And if you're a regular listener, it would be super if you cared to take a few minutes to give the show a ranking and comment at iTunes. Until next time, this is Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist, signing off. Keep measuring what matters and engaging everyone you can to do the same.